de lunes a jueves. You
the safari park. You're killing me, Larry.
Hello, Larry.
Hats off to Larry.
Larry!
Larry, get into bed now!
Come on, Larry! Larry! Larry!
Is there no sweeter sound than that of your own name buried in cheers and applause? Well, I think not. So last episode was a first for the show. A spontaneous emergency episode triggered by the United Airlines debacle. And it's the controversy that keeps on raging. What's mind-blowing about it is the faction that believes the passenger was at fault. And it leads to an actually way bigger issue. What the fuck has happened to America? Who stole all those balls? And where are they being stored? The controversy is now at the minutia level, whether the flight was overbooked or fully booked. And of course, the character assassination of this guy, Dr. Dow, is full-on. They say he's gay, he has a drug charge, he had a boyfriend while married to his wife, none of which has any bearing whatsoever on the controversy. If it was Elton John, would anybody give a shit that he's gay? Would cops drag Elton out of his seat? And I don't know if Elton's got any past drug busts, but most of our most beloved rock stars do, don't they? Do they deserve to have their teeth knocked out on an airplane? Does it matter what Dr. Dow's history is? It shouldn't. And all of this bullshit about him being randomly selected for, as they call it, deplaning, that's a lie. On every airline ticket purchase, they have a number, as long as a VIN number on an automobile. And that number code contains a frightening amount of information about that passenger, not the least of which is what his dollar value is to that airline. And if Dr. Dow had a higher dollar value, no way would he have been randomly selected for deplaning. Here's another way Dr. Dow would have been left alone. If he'd only been female, would they have dragged some chick off that plane and broken her nose and kicked out her teeth? Damned unlikely. So much for the war on women, huh? Let's shed some light on some more dancing by the airline. They claim they could not have offered more money to passengers to give up their seats because the law caps those rewards at $1,350. Well, do you think the government cares how much an airline has to bribe passengers in overbooking situations? They don't. The airline would love to offer nothing, not a fucking dime. But $1,350 is the amount some government regulators arrived at, so they wouldn't appear to be puppets of airline lobbyists, while still concerned about their constituents. Same as the maximum amount you can be compensated for lost luggage. Again, the government doesn't give a shit. But airlines beg the government to have that number etched in stone because it caps their liability at a pittance. Kind of like the way states limit malpractice payouts. And another bullshit line you see all over social media. They have to overbook in order to keep fares low. What a crock. Because airline execs care. Who buys a line of shit like that? As if the CEO of any airline is sitting in his office saying, "Hey, let's keep those ticket prices down because I want to make flying more affordable." The only motivation behind low ticket prices is to be competitive. It's got nothing whatsoever to do with concern for the consumer. There's only one goal: higher profits. And there's nothing wrong with that. I believe in capitalism. And the only good commie is a dead commie. But the airlines have perverted capitalism because they've made the government a partner and an enforcer. To really get an understanding of this story, we need to look at some history. Once upon a time, flying was actually fun. It was glamorous. Passengers were treated well. It was an adventure, not an ordeal. And some airlines were profitable and some were not. And there was an unwritten code, a motto, not unlike that of the old U.S. Postal Service. It's still chiseled into the pediment at the huge New York City post office. Neither snow, nor rain, nor heat, nor gloom of night stays these couriers from the swift completion of their appointed rounds. And not all that long ago, airlines had a similar outlook. You buy a ticket, we're gonna get you where you're going. And the only thing that may stop us is weather. Overbooking is bullshit. How do I know? Because I was there. In episode 12, I talked about a job I had as a kid working airport security before the TSA had been invented. And many a night, for a few extra bucks, I would work the late shift, waiting around until 1 or 2 a.m. and the last flight at LaGuardia came in, usually from Miami. And most times, I watched the crew exit that plane with as few as 8 or 10 passengers total. And many times I've flown on planes, maybe one-third or half full, and it was great. The old-school airline execs had scruples and honor. Some airlines were even founded by war heroes, like flying ace Eddie Rickenbacker, who started Eastern Airlines, or the amazing Howard Hughes, who was also a fantastic aviator. He bought Transworld Airlines and turned it into a powerhouse. And those guys' mindset was, hey, you paid for a ticket. We promised to get you there. So goddammit, we're gonna do it. And if it's on a half-empty airplane, well, that's our problem. We're honoring our commitment to our customers. Those guys had leather necks and steel balls. But today, airlines will get you where you want to go only if the margins are high enough. One by one, the honorable steel-balled leathernecks died off. And then the pencil-necked MBAs in finance, the spreadsheet cowboys, replaced them. And they said to themselves, hey, why should I just run an airline when I can get sick rich? And they figured out that if they could pack every flight to overcapacity and charge people for stuff that used to be included, like drinks and food and carry-on luggage or checked baggage, and make them pay extra for an aisle or window or exit row or bulkhead seat and a blanket or a pillow and preferred boarding, and then cancel flights because they're not full, well, then the airline business could be crazy profitable. And how disgustingly filthy are these planes? Now they ask the passengers and the flight crew to do the cleanup. More cost-cutting bullshit. How do I know? Because I once did that odious job. Damn near every plane on every major carrier had a cleanup crew service it between every flight. Now, planes are almost never cleaned because they run them 24/7. I was still in school and needed a job, and I saw this help wanted ad for airplane maintenance, and it paid more than minimum wage, so it had that going for it. And I had worked at the airport before, and it was kind of fun. Pointy stewardesses. That's right, stewardesses. And what exactly was wrong with that word? They used to be called stewards and stewardesses. Why is flight attendant a better word? Maybe because, as I've said before, everybody seems to demand more syllables in their job title, don't they? I bet you some pilots would rather be called airborne conveyance directors. And so I get to this dingy building at JFK. The inside looked a lot like the set from that old sitcom, Taxi. Most of my fellow job applicants looked like parolees. And the guy running the show, a short, round little guy with a cold, wet cigar stub in his mouth, he looks at me and he says, hey, kid, you got a valid license? I tell him, yeah, and he goes, all right, girls, listen up. That was the big inside joke in airplane maintenance. The guys were called girls because they were essentially doing maid service on airplanes. And short, round cigar man hands me the keys to a pickup truck and a blurry photocopied map of JFK with a list of planes we're supposed to clean. And then he says, okay, girls, this guy here in a plaid shirt, what's your name?
Larry.
Larry, he runs this crew. Come back in 8 hours for your pay envelopes. They were paying in cash. It had not occurred to me to wonder why an established plane maintenance outfit suddenly had such a big wave of hiring, or why they were paying in cash. But I would soon find out. So I get in the truck cab with a couple of my girls, and the other two guys sit in the back in the bed with a pile of vacuum cleaners and pails and mops and crap. And I try to read this map and find the first plane. I ask the guy sitting next to me if he'll navigate while I drive. He shakes his head and says, no English. I ask the guy by the door and he says, sure, as he's lighting up a joint. And it's late afternoon, and we find the first plane. We climb the stairs with all this gear and look inside. Whoa, it must have been the spring break party plane. There are beer cans and booze bottles everywhere with many a pile of congealed puke. It was pretty revolting. And on we went to plane after plane. And then around midnight, we finish up with this plane, walk down the stairs, and where the fuck is the truck? Somebody pinched the goddamn truck while the girls and I are on it mopping puke. And where that truck had been parked is an open can of Pabst Blue Ribbon pinning down a piece of paper fluttering in the wind. I look at it, and scrawled in thick ink marker is, Fuck You, Scabs. So there are no mysteries. That's why the sudden hiring spree and cash payout. We're fucking strike breakers. And we're in the middle of an airport that is 5 square miles, and we're on foot after midnight. Holy shit. No one had a flashlight, and it's damn dark. And the airport map is on the truck. The truck is who knows where. This is not good. Now, maybe guys who worked on the flight deck of aircraft carriers are used to this, but holy shit. Blinding lights, deafening sounds with no ear protection, and then the backwash from those jet engines. I felt like a flea in a clothes dryer. We start walking, and ducking planes. I recall sprinting off a runway as a pilot looked down from the cockpit of a jet, mouthing, What the fuck, at us. We crossed runway after runway, and finally, after a long time, the dingy shithole building came into sight. And I'm thinking, these assholes are gonna pitch a fit. I'm coming back with no truck. What are the odds of me even getting paid? We get into the building, and Short Round Cigar Man is long gone. Some other guy, also resembling a taxi cast member, the one more like nutty Jim Ignatowski, he gives us our pay envelopes and then asks, where's the truck? And I tell him it was stolen. And I'm expecting a major blow-up with paperwork and suspicious cops and questioning and the whole 9 yards. Instead, the guy just laughs and tells me it's the third one that's disappeared this week. And I get the hell out of there, never to return. As I'm driving home, I see a bright light up the road and a plume of smoke rising into the night sky. And as I drive by, there it is, the missing pickup truck, enveloped in flames. I was grateful I was not inside. But back to why flying sucks. Because those MBA pencil necks said, let us send legions of male and female lobbyists, whores, unto Washington, D.C. And let us give those whores unlimited expense accounts with which to tempt and tease and stroke and bedazzle and seduce fellow whore senators and whore congressmen, that they may pass outrageous laws giving we airlines all the power, so we can treat the paying customers like the freight they are. Here's a fact no one has mentioned in all this controversy. Did you know there is absolutely no limit, none, on the number of seats airlines can legally bolt into an aircraft? If they wanted to, they could stack seats, so the guy in the bottom rides with his head up somebody's ass, or fasten seats to the ceiling upside down, and you better believe some people would buy them. So over the years, not only have they shrunk the size of the seats, they've crammed a hell of a lot more of them into the planes. And then 9/11 happened, and the nation's travelers, who were pretty fed up with airlines by then, forgot all about being treated like freight and screamed, "I'll do anything, just make me safe." And those same MBAs said, "Never let a crisis go to waste." And suddenly, airlines and flight crews were given extraordinary powers, far and above those actually necessary, because everyone just wanted to be safe. And if they, like United CEO Oscar Munoz, who I expose as the arrogant firehose of bullshit in my previous episode, if they dared to even act belligerent, whatever that is, or, quote, raise their voice, unquote, as Oscar said, well then, we have government approval to whistle up some cops to deal with that 69-year-old belligerent voice-raising doctor. And those cops dealt with him by breaking his nose, knocking out a couple of teeth, and giving him a concussion. Welcome to the friendly skies. As fucked up as air travel is, there's a terrifying issue that's been uncovered by this event, and it is far, far more troubling than the mess in the skies and on the ground. The insanity of the comments on social media portend some scary times for our nation. The most common comment seems to be, like the one from United Spreadsheet Cowboy CEO, is that Dr. Dow defied authorities, that he disobeyed an order. Many said he had it coming. Wow. Well, of course, if there's a legitimate reason for a cop to give an order, that order should be followed. Orders like drop the gun, or pull over, or stop beating that kid, or put down the cash register you just ripped off from a 7-Eleven. Because all those orders stem from criminal or legitimate safety issues. But get out of that seat to a guy who has endangered no one is not a legitimate order. People are comparing this incident with Rosa Parks' famous bus ride. Many mock the comparison, but is it really that far-fetched? About 2 million people travel by plane every day, and they've had a bellyful of abuse. In the 1700s, there were a group of guys who also defied authorities. Authorities who were doing all kinds of nasty shit to people just because they could. And those non-compliant, authority-defying dudes were named Washington and Jefferson and Hale and Franklin and so on. And so what do we call this phenomenon? The sheeple? Well, maybe. It seems to go deeper. Sheeple are like jellyfish. They just go along with the flow. As long as they've got Wi-Fi access to porn and sports, they don't give much of a shit about anything. But what has surfaced here is authority worship, and a need to get down on bended knee and ask anybody in a fucking uniform for permission to breathe. Where does that mindset come from? Now, of course, the verbiage is always key in analyzing the zeitgeist. Not too long ago, cops and government agencies and so on used to ask people to cooperate. Remember that? They don't use the word cooperate anymore. Now they demand that we comply. Similar words, but the difference in meaning is vast. Cooperation implies two parties working together to achieve a common goal. Compliance is submission, surrender, and servitude. You want me to cooperate with authorities? Sure, no problem. Comply? Go fuck yourself. Airlines and some of corporate America need to be slapped senseless and reined in because they are out of control. Again, look at the verbiage. Next time you get in a beef with a phone company or utility or software outfit, see how often on their website, when it comes to resolving some dispute, an issue where you, the customer, the paying customer, have been wronged, what do they do? Instead of getting on the phone with you, they give you a Case number. Interesting word choice, and all too similar to a court of law. Shouldn't the assumption be that we, the customers, are right, and not be assigned a case number like a litigant or criminal? And there's another word you often see when you have a dispute with a mammoth corporation. After they've already fucked you, overcharged, or sold you something defective, or not made good on a promise, their websites say you may appeal, as if we, the customers, the consumers, the ones without whom they would cease to exist, are criminals appealing to the court for mercy. Why is this tolerated? And not only tolerated, but endorsed and embraced. How fucking grotesque is it to get behind a $22 billion corporation that has been rat-fucking customers for decades against some old guy who got his teeth kicked in because he refused to comply? In other words, bend over and take it up the ass. So where do these people, the authority worshippers, where do they come from? I have a theory. A few years ago, on a day when it was about 1,000 degrees here in Los Angeles, the air conditioning had broken in my home. No repair available until the following day. And so I went out in search of a cold beer and a cool place to drink it. And I found it in a joint that's a portal to a time warp. One of those bars that looks like a set from an episode of the Rockford Files. Red leather button banquettes and waiters that aren't actors who pour four fingers of scotch, and if they overpour, that's okay. And it was dark and cool, chilly almost. So I take a seat, and to my left is some older white-haired guy with shoulders like a linebacker. And we start to talk, and it turns out he'd been a sniper in Vietnam. He knew his ordnance and had some fascinating tales about blowing VC out of trees and spider holes and whatnot. And I'm really intrigued by what this guy has to say. And then a woman comes in and sits to my right. She's maybe in her mid-40s and not pointy. And just by her face, which was pinched and unpleasant, I sensed trouble. She kept trying to engage me and the sniper in conversation. And while we were not ignoring her and we were not rude, we just weren't interested in redirecting our conversation to the subject she wanted to explore. And that was what a fantastic educator she was. I guess in her little programmed Montessori world, we were in violation of her code of conduct about inclusion. I suppose we were being exclusionary. And Sarge was drinking Boilermakers, and at his size, he was putting him away pretty good. So Sarge the sniper has me deeply engrossed in a platoon of NVA getting cut to pieces by a 50 cal. Their body parts and helmets are hanging in trees like Christmas ornaments. I love hearing about killing commies. When suddenly, Ms. Montessori slams her drink on the bar, almost, but not quite hard enough to shatter the glass. Well, now she has our attention. Even the bartender looks over, and Miss Montessori Inclusion looks straight ahead at no one in particular, and in a loud, too loud voice says the following.
I have a son, a good boy, a respectful boy, a boy I am raising the right way. He respects women. He engages with them when they wish to engage with him. He says yes, ma'am, and no, ma'am. He opens doors for them and pulls out their chairs. He stands when a lady enters the room, and he excuses himself when he leaves it. He respects authority and does as he is told.
And then she slowly turns her head to the left, looking at me and Sarge, her eyes blazing, and continues.
My boy is a proper young man, a gentle young man, not a murderer who glorifies murder and guns and filth like you two ignorant brutes hold in such high regard.
And Sarge, who had a Texas twang. You know how some of those good old boys talk like they got a pebble under their tongue? Yeah. Sarge says, well, congratulations there, lady. Sounds like you got one fine girly man under construction. Does he curtsy before he kneels for truckers at the rest stops? Miss Montessori's face went from pinched to a seizure of rage. Now, I'd been drinking pretty slowly. was maybe only on my second beer with little effect. So I may have had a better awareness than Sarge the sniper who'd been pounding those Boilermakers. And something told me Miss Montessori's fuse had just been lit. As I watched her reach for her glass, I started to slide off the bar stool. And her hand came up and she threw that drink right in Sarge's face. And without so much as blinking, Sarge says, "Well, thanks for the drink, lady. Now let me buy you one." And he heaves a full beer into her face. And clearly the bartender had not been raised by a Ms. Montessori, because he came over that bar like a hurdler and hustled her ass out of the joint as she shrieked about being an educator. So when I see all these people who like to lick the boots of authority figures, to be ever compliant and ever obedient and take any shit, I think about Miss Montessori. Must be a lot of her and her offspring running around the planet by now. Unfortunately, guys like Sarge the Sniper are in dwindling supply. If you really want to know the facts about how airlines screw you at every turn, grab a book entitled Attention All Passengers, written by a guy named Bill McGee. He's done just about every job in the air travel industry except fly the plane. He knows what he's writing about. Thoroughly researched and fact-checked. There's an Amazon link to the book on my show page. In the next week or two, we'll be posting Vengeance is Ours Part 2. It's a Patreon-only episode where you learn the fate of Tommy Amante, the high school weasel who made the mistake of crossing the wrong guys. Don't miss it. And in other news, it's open. What am I talking about? Why, the Take No Shit Dojo store, of course. Our first banging t-shirt with the dojo logo on it in Gunfighter Black. Oh, it's the finest cotton. Beautifully finished. Grab one at the dojo store. There's a link to it on thatlarryshow.com. And so, my friends, thank you for visiting us at the dojo. And wherever the four winds should carry you, on land, sea, or air, remember the golden rule. The guy with the gold rules. And that's you, the paying customer. We'll see you next Tuesday, right here, at the crossroads of madness and enlightenment. And until that time, take no shit.